everyone, and thank you for joining me for this podcast all about the coronavirus or COVID-19. Now, this is a podcast that I've been wanting really to record for quite some time. It was one that my own students had requested that I record a podcast on also, but I didn't really want to record one too early because it's important that what is disseminated, if you like, the information that is relayed to people, that people hear about this particular virus, is accurate, it's detailed, it's verified information. And so what I wanted to do personally was wait until there was enough scientific evidence for me to be able to kind of describe this in a quite a general manner. But I didn't want to contradict anything that was being kind of published in the media, because I'm very much aware that these are unprecedented times and different people have taken sort of different stances and different opinions on what's going on. And so I wanted to wait for a time that I felt it was appropriate to record something about the coronavirus. So what I want to do in this podcast is just talk about the outbreak, why it spread so rapidly. And then I want to go into detail about the structure of this virus, how it replicates, how it causes cell and tissue damage, but how we can actually test patients for viral infections such as COVID-19, and how we can use new drugs and vaccines, hopefully, in the future. In December 2019, it was the city of Wuhan in the Hubei province in China that became the centre of a suspected outbreak of pneumonia. Now, at first, no one knew the cause. Chinese health authorities immediately investigated the nature of the disease and the ways to control its spread. Now, that involved isolating people suspected of having the disease and monitoring their contacts, collecting what we call epidemiological and clinical data from patients, identifying the genetic structure of the pathogen, and also developing diagnostic and treatment procedures, including attempts to produce a vaccine. Now, in January 2020, Chinese scientists isolated a new coronavirus from those patients in Wuhan. This is now called SARS-CoV-2, and it causes the disease that we know as COVID-19. It's the seventh virus from this family known to infect humans. Rapid publication of the genetic sequence of the virus helped the development of real-time point-of-care diagnostic tests specific for this virus. However, by the time the authorities realised the dangers of the virus, tens of thousands of potentially infected people had travelled far away from Wuhan. Infected patients and deaths have now been recorded across the entire world. In March 2020, the World Health Organization, or the WHO, declared the outbreak as a pandemic. A pandemic is a state where a new disease, for which people don't really have immunity, spreads around the world. Now, the WHO reacted when people who lived thousands of miles away and had never visited China became infected with this coronavirus. So, as I said, it's important really to fully appreciate this kind of subject matter. We need to look at the basics of viruses. A virus is a microscopic structure, which is much smaller than a bacteria, in fact. The simplest viruses consist of just a piece of nucleic acid, now either that could be DNA or RNA, inside a protein coat, or a capsid as it's properly called. A virus particle, or virion, cannot reproduce or exist outside of another living cell. So it needs a host, ultimately. At this point, just for my own students who may be listening to this, because we do talk about in A-level viruses in comparison to other forms of pathogen. So I just want to quickly mention how or some differences between viruses, including coronavirus, to bacteria. So viruses actually are non-cellular structures with no cytoplasm or organelles. They have, as I've said, DNA or RNA surrounded by a protein coat or capsid. They can only reproduce using a host cell, so they're parasites essentially, and they have various shapes. If we were to just, at this point in the podcast, just compare them to bacteria, bacteria do have cellular structures with a peptidoglycan cell wall and cytoplasm. Their DNA is not surrounded by this capsid, and they reproduce asexually by something called binary fission, so the cells can reproduce outside of the host cell. And bacteria typically are of the rod or the cocci or the spirilli shapes, and some actually have flagella. I think it's important actually to distinguish some of the differences between bacteria and viruses, because for me, my own personal opinion is that the better understanding that we all have about these viruses, these particularly this family of coronaviruses, I think the better we can not just prepare, but kind of just feel generally that we're more informed about what's going on. And that's why I wanted to, in this podcast, include just a few kind of side details, not specifically just about coronavirus itself, but about viruses as a pathogen. So let's talk in more detail now about the coronaviruses. So these are a group of retroviruses. Their characteristics are that they contain a single strand of RNA rather than DNA, and that there are many different types. They've been found in chickens, in turkeys, bats, camels, pigs, mice, dogs, and even cats. Now, they are zoonotic, and that means that they can pass between non-human animals to humans. Most strains of coronavirus cause mild clinical symptoms in humans, but there are more dangerous symptoms. So, for example, severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS coronavirus. Now, an outbreak in Guangdong, South China, resulted in 8,000, I believe, human infections and about 774 deaths in 37 countries between 2002 and 2003. Then there's Middle East Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus, or MERS, M-E-R-S. Now, an outbreak in Saudi Arabia caused more than 800 deaths back in, again, 2012. Coronavirus itself, it's not new, but it has occasionally mutated to form different, increasingly pathogenic strains. So, let's consider now the basic structure of this new coronavirus, or COVID-19. This virus has a single strand of RNA and only approximately 10 genes. The largest gene codes for the spike protein of the virus. The virus uses the spikes to attach to receptors on the host cells, and the cell membrane engulfs the virus. Once inside the cell, the virus is transported to a lysosome, and the two fuse together. The enzymes inside the lysosome help digest the protein coat, so the viral RNA gets released. The host cell uses those instructions on this RNA strand to construct viral proteins and to build up new viral particles. Those are called virions. It's a term I used earlier. So what happens when COVID-19 actually infects somebody? Well, the virus penetrates goblet and ciliated epithelial cells in the respiratory system. The immune system therefore responds, and it tries to remove the virus. The newly replicated virus particles burst out of the cells, and those damaged cells would naturally die. The dead tissue falls into the lungs, and they become blocked, and it's that blockage that can lead to pneumonia. Mucus, or phlegm, is usually produced to try and prevent viral entry into cells. Coughing helps to move the virus and any dead cells. Now, these would be moved by the cilia up to the throat to be swallowed to pass into the stomach, where they're then attacked by the stomach acid. However, the cilia and the goblet cells have been destroyed, so a dry cough without much phlegm develops. Inflammation of the airways irritates the nerves, and then sudden movement or a speck of dust, for example, can result in severe coughing. Inflammation in the lungs can make breathing difficult. Artificial ventilation here aims to give the lungs sufficient time to recover, but this coronavirus replicates so rapidly and it can affect large parts of lung tissue. A person's temperature increases, so fever, as a result of increased metabolic activity. That increases the efficiency of the immune response, which can also damage, sadly, the healthy tissue. more energy and resources are devoted to the immune response, which results in the exhaustion and the weakness that patients often feel. And the bones increase production of white blood cells, and that would cause aching and sore bones. Now, most people with healthy immune systems will eventually produce sufficient antibodies to overcome this virus. But people with weaker or compromised immune systems and comorbidities, so for example, they were talking about the elderly or those who may have certain types of cancer or transplant patients, they are more at risk. I want to go back at this point in the podcast to something I talked about right at the beginning, and it's where COVID-19 originated from, because there's so much out there about the origin of this particular pathogenic strain. So the virus originated in one or more non-human animals, we know that. It then spread to humans, thus making it zoonotic. Now, genetic analysis showed that the viral strain currently spreading right now as of the 13th of July 2020 among humans is 96% identical to that found in horseshoe bats. Now, some Chinese researchers believe that the virus spread to pangolins and then to humans. Pangolins are an endangered species, but are regularly targeted by wildlife traffickers and sometimes sold in markets. Other scientists have suggested that other missing links, if you like, e.g. the palm civet, a small mammal used as a food source. The corona outbreak began at a seafood market in Wuhan, which sold hundreds of these different animals. Identifying, therefore, the precise animal that transmitted the virus is now extremely difficult, as you would imagine, that market has been permanently closed. I just want to consider for a moment these zoonotic organisms. Almost all bacteria and viruses that infect other animals or plants are harmless to humans. Some zoonotic organisms are potentially lethal to humans, though. So, for example, COVID-19, get the host organism, we're uncertain, it could be bats, it could be pangolins or civets. Ebola, we know that if we think about the original host organism, is bats, chimpanzees, monkeys. HIV is believed to originate from chimpanzees. The 1918 flu, birds. Lassa fever, found to be in rats. And Rift Valley fever, known to be in livestock and mosquitoes. All of those are examples of zoonotic pathogens. Now, there are two reasons why zoonotic viruses can be so deadly. And it's, well, primarily humans lack pre-existing immunity to them. But also, these viruses aren't adapted to humans. Now, a virus that isn't adapted to a human body may kill that person. If the person dies, that virus has failed to be transmitted, so it is effectively neutralized. Random mutations may allow a virus to infect a human and cause disease, but not kill the person. That means that the virus has adapted to the human host. So how do we go about preventing future zoonotic outbreaks? Well, clearly we ban the sale of wild animals in markets. Although, if we're really unsure of the origin, we don't know how effective that could be. But it is suggested that that would dramatically prevent these kind of things happening in the future. We could compile, if you like, a watch list of all the animals that could potentially transmit viruses to humans. We could try to alter the genetic sequence of some of the virus's genes to try to make the virus less harmful or less virulent. But we could also, and this is where all our efforts right now are being focused, we could develop a vaccine. But before that, we need to know how we're testing for viral infections. And that's what I'd like to discuss now in the podcast. How do we actually test for these? And it's something called the ELISA test that can be used. Now, I talk about the ELISA test with my own A-level students. There's a variety of methods and techniques that can be employed with the ELISA test. There's not just one set procedure. There's the, for example, the contact or non-contact method. Now, the ELISA test detects the antibodies that a person produces when they are infected by the pathogen. By detecting those antibodies, medics can then determine which individuals were infected. Now, in the past, tests such as the ELISA only worked if the individual had already produced large numbers, now I'm talking billions here, of antibodies. Now, I'm not going to go into too much detail about how the ELISA works, but I'll just go through the kind of the essential kind of components of it. So antibodies would be bound to a well in a test plate. So antibodies to COVID-19 would be bound to this well in a test plate, and then serum from a patient would be added. Now, the COV binds to, by COV I'm talking about the coronavirus, clearly binds to the antibodies, but other antigens do not bind. That antibody having bound, we then have, it depends here whether we talk about, again, the direct or non-direct, because what we introduce is an antibody with an enzyme. Now, that enzyme antibody complex can bind directly to the virus, or as I often teach it, I talk about the non-direct method, I talk about it binding to the first antibody, if you like. So an antibody with an enzyme is added, and it will only bind to the first antibody if the COVID virus is, or COVID antigen rather, is present. So the second antibody would bind to the first antibody with the COV antigens attached, and the well gets washed to remove any unbound antibodies. And that's really important. A colourless substrate for the enzyme is then added, and the enzyme, if everything's gone well and it's all been activated, the enzyme will then convert that colourless substrate to a coloured product. And that would be a positive ELISA test. Now, there are advantages and disadvantages to all procedures, but particularly this form of ELISA testing. It is highly sensitive, so it can detect antibodies at the picogram level. So here we're talking about 1/1,000,000,000th of a gram. That's 10 to the minus 12 of a gram. It's highly specific because of the specific antigen-antibody relationship that exists. It's easy to perform. It's quantitative. So we actually get a numerical value rather than a subjective qualitative reading. And it can be used to test a variety of samples. So things like plasma, cell extract, saliva, and urine. But there are disadvantages that people need to be aware of. Because detection is based upon rapid enzyme substrate reactions, the test needs to be conducted very, very quickly. But it doesn't give much information about the antigen other than its simple presence and the amount. Interestingly, researchers studying the Zika virus have recently developed a microwire sensor. Now, this can detect as few as 10 antibody molecules in a person's blood within just 20 minutes, according to Wang and his team in whose research was published in 2019. Proteins similar to the ones found on the Zika virus are chemically attached to microscopic gold wires, and those proteins act as antigens. If antibodies to Zika are present in the patient's blood, they become attached to the proteins, and that allows for a quantitative assessment of the number of virus particles in the patient's blood. There's another test that we employ also, and that's the PCR test, or polymerase chain reaction, or a technique that we can use to ultimately detect viral nucleic acid. Here, a sample of cells is removed from the back of the nasal cavity or the throat using a simple swab. The nucleic acid is then separated from the cells in a lab in a process called ultracentrifugation. Any viral RNA is then converted to DNA. That DNA then gets amplified so that large quantities are created. At that point, fluorescent gene probes get added. Now, if viral DNA sequences that are complementary to the gene probes are present, those two will naturally bind. And the number of fluorescent markers can be detected in that sample. If there's no viral genetic material present, there'll be no amplification and no fluorescent markers, therefore. So, how to kind of close this podcast, how do we go about overcoming COVID-19? Well, we really have two ways to do it. We either use existing drugs and vaccines, or we develop new ones. So creating and testing new vaccines and drugs to treat infectious diseases, as many people listening to this podcast will clearly be aware, takes a very, very long time. I'm talking a significant number of years here. Now, one way of speeding that process up could be just to investigate drugs and vaccines that have already been developed. So in March 2020, the World Health Organization launched a huge global trial, and they called it Solidarity, involving thousands of individuals. So Solidarity sets out to investigate the potential of treating COVID-19 patients with existing anti-HIV drugs, malaria treatment, and the antiviral that was tried, and I should add, unsuccessfully, against Ebola. Or, as seems to be the case right now as things stand, looking to develop, as I said, new vaccines. Now, one of the most promising types of new vaccines are messenger RNA vaccines. M, or messenger RNA vaccines, are composed of the nucleic acid RNA, which codes for antigens on the pathogen. So, for example, the protein spikes on the coronavirus. Inside the patient's cells, the RNA is translated into protein antigens, which then stimulate an effective T and B cell immune response. The huge advantage of mRNA vaccines is that the virus isn't introduced into the patient, which means that the patient cannot contract the virus from the vaccine itself. I just want to say at this point, if you are interested more about the immune system and the one I talked about, T cells and B cells, so the what are known as the cell-mediated and humoral response to infection and disease, then I do have a series of podcasts very recently recorded on those topics. So do give those a listen. I want to say thank you all for listening to this particular podcast. I know we're living, as I said, in really unprecedented times, and I would encourage, if you have any questions that you'd like to pose, just get in touch at kytosbiology@gmail.com. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, Curriculum Press, for providing content that I've used in this particular podcast. So all that remains for me to say is, once again, thank you all for listening.